Hello, and welcome back to Slut PhD. I'm your host, Julie Fennell, and I am here again with my co-author and civil rights attorney, Remy Green, to continue our conversation about our book, Violated. Please listen to the earlier episode that we did on this, because this will just be a continuation of our conversation from that previous episode, talking about things that were going into writing our book. I'm going to quickly introduce
you. Unless you're just weird like that and really like listening to things out of order.
Indeed. So one of the things that happened a lot to us, especially post 2017, like Me Too stuff, people would approach me. And I think also, I think Remy and I even were on like an NPR thing together at one point, because there was this hope among a number of different sources that the BDSM subculture, bondage and discipline, dominance and submission, sadism and masochism, had the answer for non-kinky people about how to do sexual consent. And that
I remember almost thinking this.
and like, so this was a conversation I had in a number of different contexts where various journalists would reach out to me and they were like, so we heard that BDSM people are like really good at this. Can you help? And I said, probably way less than you wish that I could. but we wanted it to at least be reflected in the book, kind of to say that the BDSM subculture can teach non-kinky people or like the broader culture, I think is not quite accurate. To me, it's way more things about the BDSM subculture as a culture that make it more possible to be able to do consent better. I mean, I don't think it does it great, but I think based on what I have seen of the world that it does it better. The complication there in terms of measuring that, and there's no way we ever could, right? I have no statistics to back that up, is that people are doing so much more with so many people who they don't know well, and it's like way more out there stuff that you would expect statistically that they'd actually have their consent violated more because they're just doing a lot more. And so if I ever did look at these numbers, it would have to be some sort of per capita consent violation rate. This would be a bizarre calculation to try to make.
And then is per capita even the right way to do that, as opposed to say per encounter?
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. So by per capita, I mean per encounter. So like a great example of this that usually doesn't happen is driving. So you'll see statistics about like how often people have car wrecks, right? Like, well, you have to adjust by how many miles driven. Mm-hmm. A lot of statistics on car wrecks do that, but some of them don't. And so in this case, it's like you need to account for like how many sex acts. But also the complication in that is still going to be if the types of people who are more likely to have more encounters, who are then going to account for like a huge percentage of your overall encounters, if those people are more likely to experience consent violations because of whatever reason, right? Then that's still going to mess up your numbers. So it would always be a flawed calculation, even if I could do it, but I can't. However, that said, I do think that people in the BDSM subculture have at least put a lot of time and attention into thinking about consent, which is more than I can say for the broader culture. You know, one of the big things that I think the broader culture can take away from BDSM subculture is a much stronger emphasis on sobriety. Although even fascinatingly to me within the BDSM subculture, a lot of times when people have sex more, they are more likely to be intoxicated. When they're doing BDSM, they're usually sober, which I think is fascinating and bizarre. The other problem is that unlike what a lot of people tend to think, a lot of times BDSM subcultures don't have like nearly as much sex going on as people assume that they do. So a lot of these rules are sort of made for people doing kinky stuff more than for people doing sex stuff. It's the sobriety element is so common that I've known some people who said they came to the BDSM scene to help them stay sober. It was like part of their, so there's also just a really strong emphasis on real gender equality, meaning that, you know, women actually genuinely are allowed to have sex with multiple people without facing horrendous judgment. And I did actually study that. I never got around to publishing it. But in 2017, I was looking at that. I was like, ah, women are judged a little bit in the BDSM subculture for having a lot of sexual partners, whatever that means to people. They're judged way more for that in the broader culture. So I think that matters a great deal, especially in people's willingness to talk about what's happened to them. But also there's just like this rejection of monogamy in the BDSM subculture broadly that I think helps with that too. And so being more open to the idea that people kind of get to do whatever the fuck they want, I think really facilitates being more open about people's sexual experiences. And that in turn means that people have less reason to hide when bad things have happened to them. But that said, they do hide it a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. A lot. There's also a big influence from queer subcultural norms that means that there's just this general flexibility and openness towards how like sexual encounters are supposed to go. There's less rigidity in terms of expectations about, you know, a set of rules of who does what when, and way more just like, oh, what works for us as a pair of people. And that really, I think, both is good, but sometimes is bad, right? Because sometimes that kind of flexibility causes conflict. It's causing conflict between me and some of my friends right now. This morning, we were like having like a little text thing about it. Just like, oh, and this like group, this group dynamic situation. Like, how are we supposed to approach this thing? And like, there's no rules. My contribution to the conversation was, we don't have any rules. We have to make them up.
Like, and apparently putting the group chat on blast on the podcast is A-okay.
You know, I didn't name what group it was.
So they all are going to think it's
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It'll be great. I'm in several group chats, so they're hidden by their the safety in numbers there. Yeah, also this podcast episode probably won't air for a while, so hopefully they will have forgotten about it.
or everyone will think it is a very different bit of drama that's happened since.
Oh, yeah, exactly. The other big thing...
Subcasting, I guess that's...
is that, in general, the BDSM subculture is full of very, like, socially and politically liberal people who also tend to value open-mindedness more, and people... I've done this on surveys plenty and found like bisexuals are way more likely to have higher levels of openness to experience as a personality characteristic, for example. And, you know, I think that kind of liberalness means that people don't necessarily need, expect, or want to have rigid social norms and expectations around who does what. And that creates more environment for, again, this flexibility, which can be good and bad. Greater openness about sex and sexual desire in general. It's a close-knit social world that really gossips a lot and values reputation as a form of social capital, which frequently is hard to replicate in other contexts. Like, you can get it on a college campus, potentially, especially in the context of, say, like, a sorority, right? Any group of people who has a group chat, right? You can... No, I mean, that's become part of the way works.
No, of course.
In modern life, right? Is like some way that you have to share information with one another. So it's like, oh yeah, so-and-so did something bad to me the other night. Like, there has to be a mechanism for reporting that.
Right. And short of adding the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic to your group chat, it just can't be replicated in broader society.
Not easily. And kinky circles have a lot of ways to spread information, news. It's a very small world. And so people definitely still manage to get around it. But it is a little bit harder than if you're just, you know, on Tinder. Like, connecting with random people, right? And also, in spite of the fact that I just said, oh, there's all this flexibility, which there is, part of what really shapes the way that BDSM folks tend to do these types of negotiations when they're getting ready to do BDSM play is that there is a fairly rigid, structured form for how this is supposed to go. And like in BDSM norms, it's like the person at the top, the person who's doing the thing, or like, you know, the dom, whatever, like the person who's kind of more in charge of the sensation or experience is the person who has like a set of questions that they ask the person that they are doing stuff to. And there is an outline that everybody gets from like a BDSM 101 class for how that's supposed to go. Does it work in all situations? No. Does it work as you get more and more complex and nuanced in your BDSM desires? Not at all. It gets messier and messier kind of the further up you get into like graduate level BDSM, but it works really well when you're talking about basic like 101 level interactions. And I think that we don't really have that for a 101 level sexual encounter in the broader culture. And I know people did research on this. And again, this is not something unique to America. In fact, one of the best studies on it was in Canada. But, you know, again and again, you talk to college students and they're like, yeah, it'd be really weird if someone like asked me, do you want to have sex now? Like someone literally said in like one of these focus groups, they're like, oh, I would think that person didn't have much sexual experience. And so there's not a clear script for like how one is supposed to do that. But there also isn't a clear script for who's supposed to do the asking. And I can certainly tell you, as somebody who has had a lot of lesbian sex in my life, that particularly tends to plague lesbian sexual encounters of like, but who's supposed to do the asking here? Who's supposed to do the initiating here? In the broader culture, the idea is that men do the initiating and, you know, on some level they ask, right? If they're in heterosexual encounters. And then if you go like over to gay men's culture, you can certainly tell from all of the interviews there that they have not mastered consent at all. There's a lot of complaints among gay men about how they feel like they haven't really done consent great. And that's not to say like anybody listening to this who's a gay man, like you should get all upset. Just like on average, right? Like there's a lot of gay men who, when you interview them, are saying this is not going great, right? There's a lot of, just as there are a lot of straight women who are complaining about straight men, there's a lot of gay men who are complaining about other gay men. Whereas when you talk to lesbians about this, the complaints are way more like, but how do I even get something going in the first place? And that shows up in the numbers for these things a lot.
You know, there's something very interesting there in terms of, you know, on one hand, having a clearly assigned social role is important, or important in the sense that it seems to trigger conversations of the right structure for better consent hygiene. And on the other hand, you have kind of when those social roles are assigned kind of by something defined that is not related to the person's, you know, self or what they want, it is perhaps those structural elements of who is supposed to initiate and do what don't actually help consent hygiene.
Right.
I think that does connect to your point of one of the things that perhaps leads to better consent hygiene without necessarily having something that's teachable is that there just is flexibility and a structure that people can opt into by saying, I am a top.
Right, exactly. And it's like, you know, I struggled as I was writing this to imagine in a heterosexual encounter that's, you know, not in a BDSM context, like, I don't want to be pushing for the idea that, you know, men should be the ones asking these questions and women should be the ones answering them, which is the way the BDSM subculture frames it, of like top asks questions, bottom answers them. And, you know, even in the BDSM subculture, there's been a lot of pushback in the last few years of saying, oh, we want bottoms to ask more of these questions too, right? Like it is a problem in the BDSM subculture as well. Like, I don't want to be pushing the idea of like men should be asking, can I have sex with you? And women should be saying yes. Like that's not something that appeals to me at all as a queer feminist. And
Like,
what do I think that structure, the outline should look like? And the best I could come up with was like, ooh, whoever asked for the date,
Right. And I think that this kind of goes to, it is hard to learn much from a subculture because it is necessarily defined by being a subculture.
Exactly. And I will say, for anybody listening to this who is a woman or like a femme trying to have sex with femmes, one of the most effective strategies that I found over the years with anyone who I wasn't doing BDSM stuff with, because if I was doing BDSM, I had a frame to like hang this on, right, about who was supposed to initiate sex, basically. But when I wasn't doing something with someone in a strongly BDSM flavored context there, one of the things I would do would be to declare ahead of time whose job it was to initiate sex if sex was going to happen. And that way, basically, the idea was this should work under the principle of least interest. Like, the person who seemed the least interested in the sex should be the one who was in charge of it, so that they wouldn't be getting their consent fucked with, ideally. But to set that as a thing ahead of time, and I've given this advice to several friends over the years, and they're like, you changed my life. Thank you so much. Because once it was clear who was in charge of the thing, then it was able to proceed much more smoothly. But it does, I think, speak to the trouble then that kind of emerges in the other direction in a lot of heterosexual encounters of putting too much on that, right?
Right. Like,
and making it be clearly the man's job, right? And then I guess I'm not entirely sure what all is happening among gay men. I didn't do a ton of research on gay men's consent, just enough to know that it gets very, very messy, for sure. And, you know, some of the problem there is, I think it's two people pushing, right? But also there's just been a huge traditional thing within gay men's culture of
presumed consent.
Presumed consent, exactly. And
then spaces for presumed consent, too.
Yeah, and so, like, people opt into those spaces, but then they're not always clear about where the space ends.
What is being opted into for the space, presumably.
Yeah, exactly. And also, you have experience as a queer person in those encounters of, like, but what do two trans people do?
The answer is, you know, trauma bond, and then everything's easier from there.
It's become the new script, I think, in a lot of queer sex encounters, is trauma bond and then see where things go from there. I think that has definitely been the norm in a lot of my queer dates for like the last 2 or 3 years. Oh, wow. All right. So that's some of the thoughts that showed up for me as I spent a lot of time thinking about this, trying to decide, like, hey, but what could the BDSM subculture teach the broader culture? And I always wish that I had better answers for people on that, because I want it to be conclusive, but it's not.
I mean, I think one of the things that is in the book that you can is kind of, you know, having models for there are consent violations, and then there are kind of real consent right? Yeah. Like then there's rape, and like that things can come from poor consent hygiene, and you might want to call that person in before you banish them entirely. But like, you know, if somebody repeatedly makes the same kinds of mistakes and doesn't show the kinds of things you would expect from somebody who's trying but getting it wrong, that's when, you know, the real social penalties start going into place. And then, you know, eventually the subculture's equivalent of legal penalties start happening, right? Being banned from spaces, being on certain ban and do not play with lists.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. Right.
What scales
and I do
of
think
offense?
In the proposal in the book, we certainly take that gradation that is based on intent and try to operationalize it in a non-subcultured way.
Yeah. All right. Well, having talked about that, we're going to dig into some of the nitty-gritty bits of the book. That was a highlight of one of the sections of it, really. And go back towards the beginning of the book, because since I've got Rumi on the podcast, I am going to focus more on the elements of the book that talk about the law, even though there's a fair bit in there that actually doesn't. But one of the things that I think we don't understand about the social construction, which is tied inextricably to the legal construction of rape, is how rape laws were formed in a social and historical context that was entirely different than what we have in the present day.
Mm-hmm.
This was back in an era where marriage was a sex license. That's really what it was. And so if you were not married, the only other context really where there was any legal or social approbation at all for having sex was in prostitution, right? And so in that case, there was money being paid. And that was basically it. And anything else was already in some sort of nebulous gray zone. And so like that's the foundation of most of our rape laws. And then they've tried to slowly adapt as the cultural norms have changed. We also have to keep in mind, those cultural norms changed really fucking fast. And they are still changing really fucking fast in terms of how much people are allowed to have sex outside of marriage. You know, what does a date look like? And like how a date goes? All of these things have changed.
And also
fast.
What is a marriage, and what social function is marriage serving?
Right. I mean, these days marriage is becoming increasingly unpopular. It certainly is no longer the license to have sex that it once was, except among some very conservative social groups. Right. And so it's just not, right. It doesn't mean.
And when you say
did.
Once was, you know, you are speaking of a, you know, couple hundred year period of time where that changed, right? Like if we go far enough back, marriage has very little to do with sex.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it has to do with sex in the sense of like, if you had sex and you weren't married, that was bad. Right. Like,
right. Except when it wasn't.
Except when it wasn't, but usually that meant that there was money involved somehow.
Right.
And so
money, like, or you were, you know, royalty with an official concubine of some sort,
or you know, a slave owner with a slave,
or a slave owner with a slave.
And so those types of contexts provided a different way to understand that, but because they were special and they mostly only applied to people who were very high social status and money, right? Like, there weren't a lot of general laws about them.
Then, you know, if you start talking about common law marriage for a bit, right? Marriage was not actually accessible to many people because of the formalities. So you have common law marriage, and a common law marriage was found when people were behaving as if they were married, which included sleeping together, right? So, you know, especially among people who were not wealthy, not powerful, you did have sex before marriage, but the sex was kind of creating the marriage in the relevant sense.
Right. Well, the sex, yes, but even more childbearing, right? And that's
most of
the time, and all this is, you know, this is before birth control. And so like sex and having kids are just inextricably bound. And again, so much of like rape laws actually are really about
property
and what are you going to do if there's a kid, right? And so this is why quite a number of rape laws had as their penalty, if you were found guilty of rape, then you had to marry her, which is mind-boggling to us in a modern context, but makes sense in the sense of like, well, if she's perceived as damaged goods, she's had this illegitimate child, right? Like, we need some way to provide her and the child with legal and economic protection. And so that's how that came to be. This is just not at all much of what our modern concern is for rape, right? Like when we talk about it, it's about an offense to the body. It's an offense to the individual. Most early rape laws.
To autonomy.
Yes. And most of the early rape laws are much more about an offense to honor, to family, to like the group as a whole, which is another part of why, you know, it's like sort of built in, like fathers and brothers are supposed to go take revenge on a man for having raped their daughter, whatever, and sisters. And nowadays it's perceived very differently. It is an offense to your freedom, your independence, and we're not that concerned necessarily about whether or not there's a child, right? We've got a lot of things to prevent that from happening nowadays. And so that isn't
at least
really,
right now.
Yeah, for now. So that's way less of our concern. And our laws have only sort of caught up to that, right? So actually one of the things that I learned as I was doing research for this book was that a lot of early second wave feminist activism, which is to say the feminist activism that emerges in like the 1950s and especially into the 60s, was specifically focused around rape law reform. And in particular, the rape law reforms of trying to get the penalties for rape lowered. Because in a lot of American states at the time, death was a penalty for rape. And they were understandably afraid that this was minimizing juries' willingness to convict. And so they got the death penalty successfully removed as a penalty for rape. And that was a big part of that early activism, because they wanted to try to improve how likely someone was to be found guilty of rape. And then there's another wave of rape law reforms that happens in like the early 90s or so, to try to get marital rape made illegal. And so, as Remy mentioned in the previous episode, a lot of rape laws, even to this day, will say in them, like, a man, not his wife. And
woman,
then,
not his wife.
Right,
or
right.
Female, not his wife, is usually the...
Female, not his wife. And
because
then,
we're all Ferengi here.
And then they'll, like, add some stipulation now underneath that's like, oh, but actually you can rape your wife. And so most of that happened in the 90s or so. And by the end of that era, most states had made marital rape illegal. And then throughout a lot of the 2000s...
Although often with lesser penalties.
Oh, right. Exactly. There are still frequently lesser penalties. And then throughout a lot of the 2000s, there was a lot less rape activism. The Me Too movement inspired some definite reforms among states that had not yet gotten around to making non-consensual sex illegal. Quite a number have been. And in fact, they were changing so fast, even as we were writing the book, that I was tentative about like writing any critiques of any particular state.
Right.
Because like literally while I was writing the book, Maryland, the state that I lived in, changed its laws. And so it's been interesting seeing that emerge. And I hope that, you know, this conversation continues and that maybe we can inspire more of where that will go. There's been a lot of conversations about how the law really needs to change in order to be able to embrace more possibilities, I guess, is the way to describe it. But this is a huge part of what we get into in the later part of the book. So we titled the book Violated, and then we had a lot of conversations about how we were using words in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was still never even satisfied with the subtitle of the book.
No, which, same.
Which is Sexual Consent and Assault in the 21st Century. And the reason why I was unsatisfied with that as a title was because we were trying to get away from the word sexual assault.
Yeah.
In the book. But I was also like, well, but people won't understand that if they haven't read it yet. So I guess we're stuck with this in the title. But I'm going to take some time here to talk about our vocabulary and why we cared. So the term sexual assault also emerges in that early, like, kind of first or early second wave feminism stuff in the 60s and 70s. The term sexual assault emerges because feminist activists are trying to get away from the idea that rape equals like stranger jumps you with a gun in an alley.
Mm-hmm.
And then the term sexual assault, they were hoping, would be more broad. What actually happened with that, Remy?
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is a moment where it probably makes sense for me to take one step back, or maybe 30 steps back, but to cover that 30 steps very quickly. The American source of law, like in the constitutional sense, comes from English common law. And so common law refers to law that is developed by courts, right? Courts build on each other. And specifically, right, America in the founding era did not adopt British statutory law, but did adopt British common law as the base where our statutes and constitution, where relevant, supplanted the British common law. But the common law was underneath everything still. And I say all of that to give the context in which, skipping a whole bunch of history, in the 1960s, there was a major reform project called the Model Penal Code, run by the American Law Institute, which was an attempt to kind of get this common law mess of criminal law into something more modern, something more humane, something more rational. One of its major major innovations was really formally dividing up the way that courts were supposed to analyze crimes into a mens rea element, that's the thing that is in the person's mind, and an actus reus element, which is the thing that they do. So for example, for murder, the actus reus is killing somebody. The mens rea is intending them to die. For manslaughter, the actus reus is still killing somebody, but the mens rea is something more like without the relevant degree of care that we expect for life from people, right? So, you know, you can imagine a manslaughter charge for driving drunk and causing an accident that was unintentional, or a murder charge for shooting somebody. Again, flattening a lot, moving very quickly here. In the Model Penal Code, despite kind of being a liberalizing document in the lowercase l sense, the Model Penal Code defined rape as, quote, a male who has sexual intercourse with a female not his wife. And sexual intercourse was defined as, quote, intercourse per os or per anum, with some penetration however slight, emission is not required. And then rape was only counted if, quote, he compels her to submit by force or threat of imminent death, or he has substantially impaired her power to appraise or control her conduct by administering or employing without her knowledge drugs, intoxicants, or other means for the purpose of preventing resistance, or the female is unconscious, or the female is less than 10 years old, right? Those, that is all rape can be. Anything else is, you know, not rape. So despite being kind of a major step forward, and there's plenty of academic criticism across disciplines of the Model Penal Code's 60s version on rape it was, I think, an accurate reflection of something that was liberalizing at the moment, but, you know, the text just on its face is certainly not what culturally we think of as rape, right? We certainly think culturally, again, that men can rape their wives if, you know, they put them at gunpoint. But under the Model Penal Code, a man could put a gun to his wife's head and it's not rape. As it happens, while we were writing the book, there was a proposal, a formal proposal from the American Law Institute to update the Model Penal Code to something much more firmly in the 90s.
No, we were writing this in 2019, but we felt they were updating it to the 90s.
Right. Well, and this update came out in 2022. So after we'd already written the book, which was its own kind of nightmare. But yes, right. Much more firmly in the 90s, where it shaves off the gendered elements of it. It shaves off the female, not his wife. It kind of, broadens the acts that count, right? Sexual intercourse is no longer either per os or per anum, or no longer just that. But all of that kind of is the groundwork for the way that, and again, most states' law refers to them as model penal code jurisdictions, have a penal code that is at least somewhat based on the Model Penal Code. In some ways, that's great, right? That means that it has a firm, definite delineation between actus reus and mens rea. Those are formal. There's a default that if you don't list the mens rea element, there is a default of recklessness, right? Like the government, to convict you of a crime, has to prove that you at least were reckless, if not intending to do it. You can't do a crime by accident unless it specifically says so. And so that's kind of the world we're in. The common law part of that world is also, we have a number of courts analyzing the mens rea requirement, and rather than, even by the text of the Model Penal Code, right, you're supposed to be focusing on the intent, right, what the person doing it intended, but a lot of the case law ends up focusing on, you know, was the person being raped reasonable in perceiving a threat of imminent death or serious bodily harm? And I can't think of any other kind of bodies of law that focus on the victim of a crime in that particular way.
Yeah, we talked in the book about the idea that theft is the closest parallel. Right?
Sure.
Where it's like, well, we could spend a lot of time in a theft trial focusing on the idea of like, well, you lent it to me.
Right.
You were just lending me $10,000. I didn't steal $10,000 from you. And that's usually not how those go.
Or were you reckless in give it, right? Like, should you have known that I was not going to give you your money back, even though you technically said no?
Right.
How serious was my threat of serious bodily injury when I asked you to give me money?
Oh,
And we just don't do that.
Yep. For pretty much any other crime. It's just rape where we do this. Oh, but the other thing about those model penal code reforms, those were hung up for like 10 years, and it was specifically over arguing about the rape statutes, wasn't it?
Well, so the way that the model penal code is reformed, in scare quotes there, is they have papers, essentially, that they put out on each section. So there have been plenty of rewrites of individual sections of the model penal code, but the rape rewrites have been held up for decades at this point.
It's wild.
And they still haven't formally adopted, right? What we talked about from 2022 is still, at least, you know, I looked at it before this recording, it looks like that's still the current formal proposal, but it's only a proposal.
Which, to just translate all of that, means that even the American Law Institute, which is a bunch of smart lawyers, still cannot agree at all about how to update their rape laws, and in our opinion, can't agree on updating them to like a 90s era version, basically. Like, they can't get their rape laws from like the 50s to the 90s.
Right. We should at least be able to get to... And I think this is interesting because another thing that's important here is if you go to like the criminal law case books that are taught in law schools, almost all of them just have the model penal code in the back.
Hmm.
Because like if you're teaching criminal law to people at a law school who might go to a bunch of different states, right, you don't really want to be teaching, well, this is the very peculiar way New York does this, right? You want to, and for the bar exam, it's typically the, you know, something like the model penal code that's tested. So in terms of how we educate law students, right, the 60s reform, which is, you know, I think, frankly, not even where we were culturally in the 60s, is still what students have, you know, have to deal with in their textbooks, even right. If the textbooks also include some of the scholarship criticizing it.
Yeah. Well, so that those feminists, like the activists who were talking about like sexual assault laws, I believe it was Michigan where they initially were able to convince them to adopt these supposedly more expansive things. And, you know, and it included things like we talked about in the previous episode where it's like, oh, we're going to grade rape based on it's going to be more than just penis and vagina and maybe penis and anus, right? Like it's going to include right. these other offenses as well. And it was perceived as being very forward at the time. Like this is, I read a number of things were very praising it. So like I went and read over the penal code and I was like, wow, this doesn't look very novel to me at all. But, you know, I'm looking at it from a different time, obviously. And, you know, another element of that was just trying to change cultural conversation to say sexual assault and get out of that whole like stranger rape mentality to include more of, oh, well, a husband could rape his wife, right?
Right.
Part of the problem, I would argue, with the terminology they got there was that sexual assault doesn't verb well. And so you can say sexually assaulted, but it still doesn't verb great. And also... part of why I wanted to move away from that terminology in the book was because I feel like it still has a pretty deep implication of violence in it. Like, there's always been this argument that, oh, well, rape is violent in and of itself. And I'm like, okay, I get that, but there is still a difference between someone put a gun to your head versus they didn't, right? Those are different things. And so I think one of the things that we've really struggled with in these, especially political, but also social cultural conversations, is trying to differentiate what does that really look like in practice. And I don't like the connotation that the word assault has of where it's like the main crime is physical, because I feel like, especially as we as a culture have evolved, it feels increasingly like we talked about this violation of autonomy, that it's more than just a violation of your body. It is that, but it is also a violation of some essence of you as a human, right? And that was why we were really pushing more to use this term, both culturally and legally, of sexual violation, that emphasizes the idea of the violation being the fundamental crime. And then you can layer other physical crimes on top of it. So we imagined like a legal system in which sexual violation has its own like penalties. And then if there's also other forms of, you know, all the things that you listed in the model penal code, right? Of like, is there certain types of physical violence? Is there certain types of threats? Is there certain types of power inequities? A lot of states in their penal codes go a great length listing out like all of the dynamics that are like inherently rape, basically. So it's like, you know, like a pastor with a youth or that type of thing, where there's a presumed power inequity. And so it's like, oh, well, that can be like sexual violation in the first degree, for example, or like that could be sexual violation plus this other type of violation or inequity. And then you can add those charges together. But for now, that isn't the way that those are framed at all.
Right. And I think, as we said in the last episode, the way that that virtually every, if not every, rape and sexual assault law in the United States works right now is that the way you scale up is by changing the actus reus, right? Yeah. You change the conduct, not the intent, right? So it is this bad if you do penal violation of a vagina. It's this much worse if you do penal violation of a vagina with XYZ form of violence. But it is equivalent if you do that recklessly, and if you do that having, you know, written down a plan to do that in advance.
Yeah.
Which, you know, to me, I think that the latter is significantly worse.
I agree.
And is really, you know, is much worse than is the conduct we really want to be, if we're criminalizing conduct, criminalizing. And of course, you know, to footnote this whole discussion, right, we should also be careful about providing the government more tools to criminalize more conduct. But
yeah, I mean, we had a lot of talks about that as we were writing this. And the thing that always stuck in my mind, you said repeatedly, I'm very sympathetic to the idea that, you know, we should not have such a carceral system. Like, this is problematic, obviously. But like, most people agree that rape is one of the worst crimes, right? Is that
right.
Really where we want to target our and the,
our
and,
reform energy? Yeah,
yeah. In terms of understanding a carceral system, and I have no argument for that. Like, I was like, that's a very compelling argument. And in fact, an article that I'm going to be publishing based on the book, like one of the criticisms from one of the reviewers was, you know, oh, this is such a carceral mentality to focus on the law. And I was like, well, until we live in an anarchical system without any laws, like, I think we'd probably better keep thinking about how to make the laws better. And, you know, that's all we've got for now.
And make sure, right, like that the people who are facing serious charges are engaged in the conduct we actually find culpable, while at the same time that the people who you know, do not face as serious charges are engaged in the conduct that we think is less culpable. And I think, you know, there are both elements to the proposal in the book, right, of ensuring that conduct that is kind of at the top of what I think, call it common sense, call it, if we think about it, call it modern sensibility, says is evil.
Yeah.
That is where we should have the concentration of carcerality, and also reduce the amount of carcerality that could be brought to bear and therefore abused by prosecutors and police against people who have not really done anything other than, you know, make a mistake that, and you know, this is something else we talk about in the book, that the supposed victim doesn't think is that bad, right? One of the things we talk about in the chapter is that there's a long history of incarcerating the supposed victims of rape to force them to testify against people that they don't want to testify against.
Yeah. The other thing to sort of heavily footnote this because I know I have a lot of listeners who are international. If you're listening to this from Britain, especially, you're probably like, what the hell are you talking about? Because there, the legal conversation is exactly the opposite of the one we're trying to have here in America. Mens rea in British rape law historically has been a problem where it's overemphasized. And so a lot of the critique in British rape law writing is about not focusing on mens rea so much, where historically it's like there was just this hyper focus on, well, proving, you know, all these details of what exactly did the person accused of rape, like, know, believe, or whatever, to the point of, like, kind of ignoring other things, right? And so it's a good cautionary tale, I think, as we're pushing for American rape law revision to say, okay, you know, you can go too far in the other direction here, for sure. My impression of those laws is they also still aren't graded well.
Right.
They still don't do a good job of differentiating between, Remy, we've got intentional, reckless, what's our system here? Negligent?
Yeah, it's purposely, intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, and negligently.
Right. And those are the scales of intentionality there, which to the best of my knowledge is still not really present in the British construction of rape either. And so I think lacking that nuance, you just end up with still a really unsophisticated conversation about the way these things happen. And I think it's also super important to recognize that this isn't just in a legal context, right? I think this should also be part of our conversation when our friends come to us and we're like, you know, one of the things I talk a lot in the book is about sort of the jury of your living room, right? Where someone has come to you and tells you some terrible thing that has happened to them. And like, where do we want the line to be? And I don't have an easy answer for this of like, where do we want the criminal justice system to actually be involved? Because a lot of people complain when they look at the statistics about how many rapes don't get reported to the police. And, you know, one of the things I keep asking over and over again in the book, but I also try to just ask generally to anybody is, what do you actually think you want the criminal justice system involved with in general, but also here? Because a lot of the time, sexual violations kind of come down to a domestic dispute, right? And it's like, do I really want, one of my friends uses the phrase, a guy with a gun, to refer to the police. Do I really want a guy with a gun involved in this particular dispute? I mean, the answer is frequently no, right? The whole thing needs to be overhauled. It'd be great if we had like social workers who were called to address a lot of these issues rather than the police, which is some of the problem. But like,
I think that also gets to, right, the problem with grading it the way we do,
yeah,
such that, right, somebody who, you know, does fuck up, to use the technical legal term.
Oh yeah.
And while drunk, without a plan in advance, versus somebody who has, you know, planned, purchased date rape drugs, and taken away somebody's ability to stop the thing from happening, and because there is no gradation in the intent, those are the same offense, right?
Right.
They are the same act performed with the minimum degree of culpability.
Yeah, and it just doesn't seem like that's remotely reasonable or fair. And the other big thing that really shows up in a lot of the research that people have done, where they were interviewing people who were accused of sexual assault, was just how stunningly many of them, these were not people who'd been arrested. These are like college like offenses, right? It's like they were really shocked, the people who were doing the research, by how many of these perpetrators were really not bad people. And they're like, the authors write about like how these people's lives have been ruined by this, not just because they were kicked out of school or whatever, but because they feel so guilty and so bad because this was never what they meant to do, right? And I feel like it remains an open question to me that warrants a lot more social conversation and investigation. Is the guy who holds a gun to a woman's head and forces her to have sex, is he on the same scale as the guy who was drunk, who had sex with another drunk woman, and like, didn't clarify that she wanted to have sex, right? And I don't know. Like, I genuinely don't know the answer to that question. It might all be part of the same social problem. My gut instinct says no, but...
I think maybe the more important point is, even if they're on the same scale, they are different. They are certainly almost poles on it, right?
Right. Well, I mean, the reason why I care about whether or not they're on the same scale is because it has implications for what the correct social intervention is.
And right. Part no, of why... fair enough. But I think, you know, again, getting back to murder, right? We do think very differently about a premeditated murder and somebody who, you know, knowing better, gets in a car drunk and kills somebody.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Like, we they've both committed similar crimes in a certain sense, but what we as society want to do about it is going to be meaningfully different because how they got to that point is different.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons that I talk about that is because there's been some pushback from some like feminist activists about the idea of like teaching women to say no. They're like, no, we just need to teach men not to rape. And I'm like, no, let's do both. Let's do both. Right. And at least one study that I found, and it's just one, and it's only on Columbia University because they did a lot of work on there. They found that there was a substantial effect for young women who had grown up in programs where they had sex education and they were taught to say no, were much less likely to be sexually violated on those college campuses, which to me says that these things are different because presumably the person who's putting a gun to your head to have sex with you knows that you don't want to, right? Like, and that's part of why they're doing it. And so I think that there is a real difference going on there. And I personally don't think that we necessarily want the legal system, at least the formal, like, criminal justice legal system involved in these ones that are, like, no, right. you didn't set out to do it intentionally, right?
I mean, the other thing I do think is important to say, you know, I think we criticize in the book quite a bit the system that, you know, disregards what the victim wants. And yeah. The flip side of that is I do think that, you know, you're going to have problems, you're going to have bad faith edge cases where this is not what's going on. But some level of trusting people to do that sorting on their own is probably appropriate, right?
Yeah.
Right? Like, if somebody is saying, I don't want the police involved, but and that happens a lot, you know, you have the missing stare problem there, referring to, you know, somebody who everyone seems to know is a problem, and you get warned if you're in the relevant community, but you can accidentally step through the missing stair if you're not warned. But at the same time, right, like, you do have the fact that if somebody is going to the police, you can probably assume there's some amount of background that they know and that they've tried to solve things other ways.
Yeah.
I do also want to step back because I just pulled it up and I'm doing something dangerous here and reading English law as an American.
Oh, interesting.
But I pulled up what I'm fairly sure I've gotten is the correct section of how British law under the Sexual Offences Act of 2003 defines rape. And it is interesting, right? It's he intentionally.
They have, I think, modified that, but I'm not sure.
Well, I think that also is probably he has been interpreted to be generic in this law.
Hmm.
This is the law that's currently in force. But penetrates the vagina, anus, or mouth of another person with his penis. They do not consent to the penetration. I think this is what you were getting at. The third element is that the person does not reasonably believe that the other person consents.
Yes.
And so... Right. That sets a, I think, in American monopenal code, more or less a recklessness standard.
Yep. Yep.
Right. And so it actually, there are two intent elements, right? The physical act has to be intentional, which is, you know, that it interesting. We can talk about that. But then you also have to be reckless with regard to the other person's consent. Right. So there are two acts with two different states of mind. And it doesn't look like, at least looking at this definition of rape, that they grade it based on different, but just that there is kind of a, almost a lower mens rea element than you would typically expect in most American law with regard to intent, right? And then you also have this other definition, whether a belief is reasonable, is determined having regard to all the circumstances, including any steps the person has taken to ascertain whether the other person consents.
Yep. Yeah, and it's been the subject of a lot of controversy and argument in British legal discourse.
No, of course. And the only point I suppose I'm making is, right, this is still not doing the thing that I think we think should be done, right, which is really focusing on different states of mind really are, I think, intuitively what we think are the differences in how bad the act is.
Yep. Yep. And I think the failure of that, it's what leads to so many shitty conversations. This is one of the parts that I get to in the conclusion. I had a lot of people asking me as I was writing the book, they're like, how was that for you? And I spent like a year just doing a deep dive into rape and writing about rape all the time. Like, how did you manage that? And I was like, well, you know, I definitely had to stick away from stuff that was too traumatizing or triggering for me. And like, I would skim when I needed to. And, like, I actually was, you know, mostly dealing with fairly broad statistics, so it wasn't too much stuff that felt, like, deeply impactful and personal a lot of times. It's just kind of numbers on a page. But when I wrote the conclusion of the book was when I started crying. And the reason why I started feeling so emotional about it was, I think the reason why we end up having a lot of really shitty conversations with our friends of like, who had, someone comes to you and they had a bad experience. And like, so often our gut response is to say, well, but was that really rape?
Right.
And like, I actually had done this, right, as I, when I was in college. And I was like, and I stand behind my argument that like, the thing that had happened to this person does not meet a legal standard for rape. And I do not think that it should. But A, the fact that they're suffering is really important. And B, the fact that it is possible that you can have something bad happen to you without someone else being at fault is just something that is not part of our cultural conception. And I feel very passionately about that now, especially. And then also, I think part of why we end up having these shitty conversations is because we aren't grading this. It isn't nuanced. And I, at like 19, having gone to a all-girls high school where the sex ed class opened with the teacher telling us she was a virgin, did not have access to the kind of nuance and vocabulary and sophistication in my analysis that I do now. And I feel like it really sucks because obviously the people we know numerically who are the most likely to experience this are the ones is between ages 16 and 24, right? And so they're young. They haven't had all of that life experience to, and the people that they're going to for help are their friends who also are young and haven't had a lot of chances to be well educated in all of this. And so, you know, I had a lot of emotional response to thinking back on my own experiences of that and just like wishing I could go back in time and be more supportive in ways that were more helpful to my friends, but also like that they would have been educated better too, right? That we wouldn't, neither of us would have found ourselves in this situation. And that's what I really hope people will take away from the book more than anything is just like, what happens if we make more nuance in our law and social conversations, and especially when we add gender to that? Like, where does that get us? And I hope people will read the book and actually take those things seriously. And also, it's not like we have a ton of answers in the book. It's like we just really want to start a conversation. We want to change the tone of the conversation too.
Not to like, you know, ruin the little button that was very neatly put there, but I do want to jump in with kind of a mirror to the thing you're saying, because our conversation today and in the book to a large extent has been focused on criminal law, and that leaves out civil law and the multiple contexts in which violation type conduct can be litigated and accountability can be had through civil law. Two most common would be when somebody sues somebody else for that conduct, whether under assault, under some kind of civil sexual assault law or something like that. And then also kind of the mirror of it in defamation law, where somebody sues another person for accusing them of sexual assault. And I do want to just kind of flag as an important place for additional conversation, let's say, and further reading and another paper or book or what have you, that the experience you're describing, Julie, right, And saying, well, is that rape actually often gets played out in my own practice where people get sued for talking about their experiences and labeling it rape with hyper-technical, well, that doesn't meet the legal standard for rape in the state where this happened, and therefore you've defamed me, right? And often to mixed results from courts where I do think, you know, saying rape is something colloquial as well as legal.
Yep.
And I don't know exactly where to fit that in, and I don't mean to disturb the lovely button our conversation had, but I think that, that is also something important in our conversation.
Well, it's just, I think so much of this conversation needs to be asking, like, where's the line, right? Where's the line for a civil thing? Where's the line for a criminal thing? Where's the line for, where we want a person with a gun involved? And where's the line where we might ideally want a social worker involved? Where's the line where we want the punitive board at the college involved, right? Like, these are, and I think we haven't been asking that.
I mean, maybe more importantly, I think we have been asking, where is the line? We haven't been asking, what tools are we using to draw the line?
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's really the point of the book, not to tell you the point of the book that you wrote most of.
We spent a lot of time formulating this together.
But I think the thing we are trying to say is not necessarily this is where you draw the line, but that we're going about the process of drawing the line procedurally and structurally in a way that doesn't really get at what is actually going on in the problem, and that the heritage of how we are drawing the line is dealing with a different set of problems and a different set of goals than the ones that we ostensibly have when we are talking about rape and sexual assault law.
That is a great way to end this. So I hope that we have piqued your interest enough to want to read our book, which is full of a lot of different ideas and thoughts on this very complicated subject. And if you're looking for the simple book with the simple answers, this isn't it. But, we worked very hard on this for a long time, and hopefully this has given you a good taste of what's in there. But you might be interested in going to read more after you've listened to these podcast episodes. And obviously, thank you, Remy, for talking with me about this for a couple of hours. And
thanks for having me.
It was a crazy journey that we had together to make this book, and it's fun to talk about it. So thanks.
Well, fun might not be the right word.
Oh, well, okay, fair. But like, I mean, I find it valuable. Fun to sit around and debate ideas. It just is a topic that's, kind of grim, but
important. Gratifying, yeah. Perhaps.
Gratifying. There we go. It's a very gratifying topic to work on. So thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.